and Papa might not approve. Splendid, she says, and hands me money for paint. At the A.S. Thales & Sons general store, after school, I pick up a gallon of the most vibrant blue on the chart, two horsehair brushes, a tin tray, and a can of turpentine, stashing it in the woods when I'm too tired to carry it all the way home. The next day, when I check the spot where I left it, it isn't there. I'm afraid someone has stolen it. But when I get to the house, it's sitting in the shed. I still think it's a silly idea, Al says. But I can't let you do all the work by yourself. The wet paint is the color of the bluest feather on a bluebird, as shiny as the surface of a lake. With old rags, Al and I wipe down the shed doors, the wagon rims and chassis, the sled and hay rack and geranium pots. Once we start painting, it's hard to stop. We go back to Fales for more supplies and return to paint the front and back doors, all of the wagon beds. When we persuade Mother to come downstairs and see what we've done, she pulls Al and me into a hug. Slowly, things improve. As the weather warms, Mother and I resume our walks to Little Island at low tide. But now we bring my brothers, too. Al runs ahead through the grass. Sam piles starfish in a tide pool. We roam the pebbled beach, searching for shells and stopping for a picnic under the old spruce tree. Mother takes baby Fred out of his sling and lays him on his back on the beach, where he coos and gurgles. I sit on a rock watching her. She seems better, I think. But now and then I see her staring off into the distance with a blank expression on her face. And it worries me. When Mrs. Crowley copies a poem by Emily Dickinson on the chalkboard in her neat cursive, the muttering begins. Did a six-year-old write that? What are those dashes? Is that proper grammar? My grandpa told me she was just a strange old lady, a spinster, says Gertrude Gibbons, the class know-it-all. Emily Dickinson did have a quiet life, Mrs. Crowley says, tucking a strand of gray behind her ear. A man broke her heart, and she became something of a recluse. She only wore white. Nobody even knew she was a poet. She was admired for her beautiful garden. She would sit for hours at a little desk, but nobody really knew what she was doing. After she died, a folder of her poems was discovered in a drawer. Page after page in her precise script, with very odd notations, as you can see. Hundreds and hundreds of poems. As I copy the poem on the chalkboard into my notebook, I mouth the words to myself. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know.
It doesn't even rhyme, Leslie Brown says.
So what do you think it means? Mrs. Crowley asks, holding the chalk in the air.
I don't know. She feels like her life doesn't matter. That's one interpretation.
Christina, what do you think?
I think she feels like she's different from most people, I say. And even if they find her strange, she knows she can't be the only one. Mrs. Crowley smiles. She seems to be about to say something, then changes her mind. A kindred spirit, she says. After class, I ask her if I can read more poems by this poet I've never heard of. Picking up a small blue, hard-backed volume on her desk, she shows me that Emily Dickinson often used common meter, alternating lines of 8 and 6 syllables, a form more typical of hymns. That she wrote most of her poems in slant rhyme, in which the rhyming words are similar, but not exact. And she employed a figure of speech called synecdoche, wherein the part stands in for the whole. For example, here in this poem, Mrs. Crowley says, tapping a page and reciting the words aloud, the eyes around had wrung them dry. What do you think this refers to? I scan the first few lines of the poem. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The people standing around the bed, mourning the one who died? Mrs. Crowley nods. She hands me the book.
If you'd like, you may take this home for the weekend.
Sitting on the front stoop of my house after school, I thumb through the pages, alighting here and there. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. The simple news that nature told, with tender majesty. The poems are peculiar and inside out, and I'm not sure I know what they mean. I imagine Emily Dickinson in a white dress sitting at her desk, head bent over her quill, scratching out these halting fragments. It's all right if you don't exactly understand, Mrs. Crowley told the class. What matters is how a poem resonates for you. What must it have been like to capture these thoughts on paper? Like trapping fireflies, I think. Mother, seeing me reading on the stoop, dumps a basket of air-dried sheets in my lap. No time for lollygagging, she says under her breath. Near the end of eighth grade, the final year of Wing School Number 4, and the last year of any kind of schooling for most of us, Mrs. Crowley takes me aside during a lunch period. Christina, I can't do this forever, she says. Would you be interested in staying on for another few years to get qualified to take over the school? I think you'd make an excellent teacher. Her words make me glow with pride, but at supper that evening, when I report the conversation to Mother and Papa, I see a look pass between them.
We'll talk about it,
Papa says, and sends me outside to sit on the stoop. When he calls me back in, Mother is looking at her plate. Papa says,
I'm sorry, Christina, but you've had more schooling than either of us ever did. Your mother has too much to do. We need your help around here.
My stomach plummets. I try to keep the hard edge of panic out of my voice. But Papa, I could go to school only in the mornings, or stay home when I'm needed.
Trust me, you'll learn more on this farm than you'll ever learn from a book.
But I like going to school. I like what I'm learning.
Book learning doesn't get the chores done.
The next day, I plead my case to Mame. Later, I hear her talking to Papa in a low voice in the parlor.
Let her stay in school a few more years, she says. What can it hurt? Teaching is a fine profession, and let's face it, there's not much else available to her. Katie isn't well, you know that. Christina is needed here. You need her here. We can manage, Mame says. If she doesn't do this now, she might end up on this farm for the rest of her life. Is that so intolerable? It's the life I chose. But that's it, John. You saw the world and then you chose it. She's never been farther than Rockland. And remember what a success that was? She couldn't wait to get home. She was young and scared. The wider world is no place for her. For pity's sake, we're not talking about the wider world. We're talking about a small town a mile and a half from here. My decision is made, Trofina.
Telling Mrs. Crowley at recess the next day that I can't stay in school is one of the hardest things I've ever done. She is silent for a moment. Then she says, You'll be fine, Christina. There will be other opportunities, no doubt. She seems a little teary. I am teary, too. She has never touched me before. But now she puts her delicate hand on mine. I want to say, Christina, that you are unusual. And somehow, her voice trails off. Your mind, your curiosity, will be your comfort. On the last day of school, I am so full of self-pity that I can hardly speak. On my way out the door, I linger in front of Mrs. Crowley's globe, ordered from a Sears Roebuck catalog, and turn it with a finger. The ocean is robin's egg blue, with bumpy raised green and tan parts representing continents. I run my fingers over Taiwan, Tasmania, Texas. These faraway places are as real to me as the treasure buried in Mystery Tunnel, which is to say, it's hard for me to believe they actually exist. After I leave school, time stretches ahead like a long, flat road visible for miles. My routine becomes as regular as the tide. I rise before dawn to collect an armload of firewood from the shed, dump it into the bin beside the Glenwood range in the kitchen, and go back for another. Open the heavy black door of the oven. Use the poker to stir the ashes. Find the faint embers. Add several logs. Coax the fire along with kindling. Shut the door and press my cold, stiff hands against it to warm them. Then I rouse my brothers from bed to feed the chickens and pigs, the horses and the mule. They grumble all the way down the stairs about who scatters the feed, mucks the stalls, collects the eggs. While the boys are in the barn, I fix a pot of boiled oats with currants and raisins for their breakfast, and make sandwiches of butter and molasses on thick sourdough bread, wrapped in wax paper for their lunches. Gather vegetables and apples from the cellar, a basket looped over my arm as I make my way down the rickety wooden ladder. Al forgets a book. Sam his pail. Fred his hat. When they're finally out the door, I wash their dishes in the long cast-iron sink in the pantry. Then I start the process of baking bread, pinching off the sourdough starter I keep in the pantry, sprinkling flour over the wooden board. I make beds, empty night jars, limp to the garden to pick squash for a pie. After school, Sam and Fred help Papa in the barn and the fields, and Al goes out in his boat. In the late afternoon, when the boys' other chores are done, they work on the fish weir that stretches between Little Island and Pleasant Point. Before supper, they have to be reminded to wash, to take their boots off, to come to the table. I have plenty to think about, I suppose. Will the bread rise properly if I use a different kind of flour? How many servings will one anemic chicken provide? How much money will the wool of 8 sheep bring in after adjusting for expenses? I know how to get the hens to lay more. Give them extra salt. Keep the henhouse windows clean to let in light. Grind lobster shells into their feed. Our healthy hens produce more than our family can consume, so Al and I start selling the eggs. I spend several hours each month sewing bags out of cheesecloth to store them. Despite my crooked hands, I am becoming a reasonable seamstress. In the afternoons, I darn and patch the boys' hard-worn trousers and shirts and socks, and spruce up old dresses with new collars and cuffs. Before long, I am sewing all my own skirts and blouses and dresses on Mother's treadle singer in the dining room, with its pretty red, green, and gold fleur-de-lis pattern, its rounded form like an arm bent at the elbow. From her book of patterns, I learned to sew a 3-panel skirt, and then one with 5 panels. Buttonholes are hardest. It takes my clumsy fingers ages to get them right. Mother believes pockets on skirts are inelegant. She shows me how to sew a secret pouch into the lining so no one can see. A lady doesn't reach into her pocket in view of others, she says. I find her formality a little silly. It's only us here, and the boys neither notice nor care. With no running water, we collect rain and melted snow from gutters and downspouts in the large cistern in the cellar, and dredge it up using the hand pump in the pantry. Al figures out how to attach a funnel from the downspout to a hose to collect water for the cistern, making the process more efficient. When we run out of water in the cellar, I harness our mule Dandy to a wooden drag loaded with 2 empty barrels, corral one of the boys to help, and lead her to the pasture spring 1/2 mile away to fill them. Laundry once a week takes at least 1 full day. And sometimes 2. I boil water on the range and pour it from the large black pot into a wide steel tub, then scrub the laundry on a ribbed washboard and run it through a hand wringer before hanging the dripping sheets and shirts and undergarments to dry. It's not easy, with my uneven balance, to pin clothes on the line outside. But I discover that I can detach the rope from the 2 poles on either end and pin the laundry on it while it's on the ground, then raise the line, with damp clothes hanging from it like a charm bracelet. When it's too snowy to go outside, I hang clothes in the shed. They stay damp for days. The smell of mildew lingers until spring. I make soap when we need it, by combining water with lye and adding oil, then pouring the mixture into molds and letting it dry for several days before turning the bars onto wax paper and putting them in the pantry to cure for a month. I scrub the floors with bleach and well water until my knees and knuckles are red, splotching my dress with white. With my shaky balance, even these ordinary tasks are fraught with peril. My arms and legs are marred and scarred from run-ins with boiling water, toxic bleach, poisonous lye. When I mutter about these minor injuries, or that too much is expected of me, Al says, "We have a roof over our heads. Some people don't have that much." It helps to remember this, I guess. But it's hard to shake my sadness at having been taken out of school. Only Mamay understands. "You inherited my curiosity, child," she says. "More's the pity." As time goes on, I find ways to make it bearable. I save 3 unwanted kittens and choose a runt from a neighbor's cocker spaniel litter and name him Topsy. I order seed packets and plant a flower garden like the one Emily Dickinson kept, with nasturtiums and pansies and daffodils and marigolds. A butterfly utopia, she called it. When my flowers bloom, they lure yellow and black monarchs, cabbage whites, teal blue swallowtails. I find a poem I copied in my notebook. 2 butterflies went out at noon and waltzed above a stream, then stepped straight through the firmament and rested on a beam, and then together bore away upon a shining sea. I imagine these butterflies traveling the world, alighting in my garden for a short time before heading off again. Dream that someday I might grow wings and follow, fluttering behind them down the field and across the water. I try not to think about what I'd be doing if I weren't tied to the farm. Anne and Mary Connors are both continuing their studies, I hear. Anne wants to be a nurse, and Mary a teacher. There's talk about her taking over from Mrs. Crowley. When I'm doing errands in Cushing, and see one of them from afar, at the hardware store or the post office, I cross to the other side of the road. When I was a child, Mamay would whisper, "You're like me, Christina. Someday you'll explore distant lands." But she has stopped talking like this. Now she just wants me to get out of the house. Unlike my parents, who don't speak of such things, Mamay is always trying to convince me to mingle, as she calls it. "Pity's sake, you need to be with people your own age," she says. "Isn't there a social or a picnic you could go to?" Al has no interest in the dances that are held on Friday evenings at the Acorn Grange Hall in Cushing, so I go with my friend Sadie Ham. We walk along the rutted path in the semi-darkness, linking arms with several other girls. Sadie always breaks the chain when I fall behind, as I often do, stumbling in the ruts. She pretends she wants to gossip, but really she's providing ballast. Sadie wears dresses with lace-trimmed sleeves and pearl buttons. Hand-me-downs from her sister, she says, but fancier than anything I own. I wear navy blue skirts and white muslin shirt blouses with buttons at the front. A long, dark skirt is forgiving. My misshapen legs aren't as obvious behind its folds. On the way to the dance, Sadie sings silly songs and makes a fool of herself, turning cartwheels in her dress. She wears pink lip stain and powder that her sisters bring home from the drugstore in little containers. I envy her free and easy laugh, the way she skips along without fear of stumbling. I wish I dared to speak to the boys at the Grange Hall and get out on the dance floor instead of swaying to the music on the sidelines. Later, when I'm home in bed, I conjure entire conversations I might have had with a boy named Robert Allen, whose brown eyes and wavy hair I found so appealing that I could hardly bear to look at him directly, even from across the room. And then, in my imagining, the music starts. "May I have this dance, Christina?" Robert asks. "Why, yes," I say. He extends his hand, and when I take it, he pulls me close, his chest warm against mine. Through my blouse, I feel his other hand on the small of my back, guiding me gently, firmly, as he moves forward on his left foot and I step backward with my right. 2 slow steps, 3 quick ones, hold, forward, forward, side to side. I drift to sleep, hearing the music in my head, moving my toes to the rhythm. 2 slow steps, 3 quick ones, hold. 2 slow steps, 3 quick ones, hold. At 80, Mame seems to float more than ever on the aquamarine oceans of her past, where the sand is as pale and fine as sugar, and the smell of tropical flowers lingers on the air. Her eyelids flutter as she dips in and out of dreams, sinking deeper into herself. She can't get warm, no matter how many feather ticks and blankets I pile on. I heat a stone in the oven, her old trick, and slide it under the covers to the foot of her bed. One day, I bring her a conch from the shell room, its innards as pink and glistening as an inner lip. Gripping the bony conch, she tells me how she found it on a deserted beach on an expedition to Cape Horn with Captain Sam. Sand under their toes and leafy palm fronds overhead, shielding them from the sun. Siesta on a porch and grilled fish and vegetables for supper. "Next time I'll take you with me," she says softly. "I would like that," I say. Mame's hair is thin and yellowed, her skin as freckled and translucent as a meadowlark egg, her eyes searching, unfocused. Her bones are as delicate as a bird's. Mother comes into her room every day and flits around for half an hour or so, fussing over the bedsheets and picking up soiled linens. "It pains me to look at her," she tells me, perching on the edge of Mame's bed, gazing up at the ceiling. Mother sings one of her own favorite songs, an old gospel tune she learned in church as a child. "Will there be any stars in my crown, when at evening the sun goeth down, when I wake with the blessed in those mansions of rest, will there be any stars in my crown?" I wonder what those stars are meant to represent. They must be proof that you are especially worthy, that you shine a little brighter than everyone else. But if you wake with the blessed in heaven, isn't that enough? Haven't you achieved the most you could have hoped for? The words seem at odds with Mother's personality, her negligible ambitions, her lack of interest in anything beyond the point. Maybe she believes that the way she lives is the height of righteousness. Or maybe, as she's said before, she just likes the melody. My father comes upstairs now and then and lingers in the doorway. My brothers drift in and out, rendered speechless in the presence of such profound dissolution. But I can't really blame them. Mame always called my brothers "those boys" and kept a wide berth from them while pulling me close. "Mame, I'm here," I murmur, stroking her arm and holding it to my cheek. Her breath on my face smells like scum on a shallow pond. When she finally dies, it is after days of not eating and barely drinking, her skin tightening across sunken cheeks, her breathing becoming raspy and labored. I think of that poem, "The eyes around had wrung them dry." The day we bury her is dreary, a colorless sky, gray-boned trees, old sooty snow. Winter, I think, must be tired of itself. Reverend Cullen of the Cushing Baptist Church, in a eulogy at Mame's grave in the family cemetery, talks about how she will rejoin the ones she loved who are gone. But as I watch her pine casket descend slowly into the dirt, I try to envision the reunion of a frail 80-year-old woman with her decades younger husband and their 3 sons, and am left with the lingering feeling that the places we go in our minds to find comfort have little to do with where our bodies go.
Waiting to be found. 1942 to 1943.
As the war heats up, we see transport ships far out at sea. Soldiers sent down from Belfast roam our property in green jeeps, patrolling the coastline, scanning the horizon with binoculars. Al is amused.
What do they think is going to happen here?
When one of the soldiers knocks on the door and asks if I'm aware of any suspicious activity, I ask him what on earth he means.
Reports of enemy ships in the area, he says darkly. The Cushing waterfront has been declared unsafe.
I think of the villainous pirates in Treasure Island and their telltale black flag with skull and crossbones. Our enemy, if one is lurking around, probably doesn't announce itself so plainly.
Well, I've seen a lot of activity out there lately, more than usual. But I wouldn't know if it's friend or foe.
Just keep your eyes open, ma'am. Soon enough, Cushing is subjected to intermittent blackouts and rationing.
This is worse than the Depression, Fred's wife Laura exclaims. There's barely enough gasoline to do my errands.
Cottage cheese is a sorry substitute for ground beef. I can't for the life of me get Sam to eat it, says my other sister-in-law Mary. None of it affects Al and me much. A poster on the wall in the post office instructs citizens to use it up, wear it out, make it do. But that's the way we've always lived. We've never had electricity, so blackouts are nothing new. They happen every night when we extinguish the oil lamps. And though we've come to rely on the Fayle store for milk and flour and butter, most of what we eat comes from the fields and the orchard and the chicken coops. We still store root vegetables and apples in the cellar, and perishables in an icebox under the floorboards in the pantry. Al does his butchering. I boil and crank the laundry, as I've always done, and hang it in the wind to dry. It's a cool September day when my nephew John, the oldest son of Sam and Mary, pulls up a chair in my kitchen. A lanky, mild-mannered boy with a lopsided grin. John has been my favorite nephew since he was born in this house 20 years ago.
I have something to tell you, Aunt Christina.
He clasps my hand. I hitched a ride to Portland yesterday and enlisted in the Navy.
Oh!
I feel stricken. Do you have to? Aren't you needed on the farm? I knew I'd be called up sooner or later. If I'd waited any longer, I'd have been drafted by the Army into the infantry. I'd rather do it on my own terms.
What do your parents have to say about it?
They knew it was only a matter of time. I pause for a moment, absorbing this.
When do you leave?
In a week.
A week?
He squeezes my hand. Once you sign on the dotted line, Aunt Christina, you're as good as gone. For the first time, the war feels starkly real. I put my other hand over his.
Promise you'll write.
You know I will. True to his word, every 10 days or so a postcard or a pale blue onion-skin letter from John arrives at the post office in Cushing. After 6 long weeks of basic training in Newport, Rhode Island, he is assigned to the USS Nelson, a destroyer that escorts aircraft carriers and patrols for enemy ships and submarines. After that, the postmarks become larger and more colorful. Hawaii, Casablanca, Trinidad, Dakar, France. Our seafaring ancestors. Mamay would be pleased. Sam and Mary erect a flagpole in their yard and hang a crisp new American flag for all to see. They are proud of John for serving his country. Mary coordinates scrap iron drives to collect copper and brass for use in artillery shells, and organizes get-togethers with other wives and mothers of servicemen to knit socks and scarves to send to the troops.
Our boy will come back a man, Sam says.
I join Laura's knitting circle and go around the house and barn gathering bits and pieces of metal to send to the war effort. But with John overseas, I sleep fitfully. All I want is for him to come home. I read once that the act of observing changes the nature of what is observed. This is certainly true for Al and me. We are more attuned to the beauty of this old house, with its familiar corners, when Andy is here, more appreciative of the view down the yellow fields to the water. Constant, and yet ever-changing. The black crows on the barn roof, the hawk circling overhead, a grain bag, a dented pail, a rope hanging from a rafter. These ordinary objects and implements are transformed by Andy's brush into something timeless and otherworldly. Sitting at the kitchen window early one morning, I notice that the sweet peas I planted years ago have flourished beyond all reason in their sunny spot beside the back door. Taking a paring knife from the utility drawer and a straw basket from the counter, I make my way to the vine and clip the fragrant blossoms, cream and pink and salmon, letting them tumble into the basket. In the pantry, I take Mother's tiny, dust-covered crystal vases from a high shelf and wash them in the sink, then fill them with sprigs. I find spots for the vases all over the ground floor, on the kitchen counter, the mantel in the shell room, a window sill in the dining room, even in the four-hole privy in the shed. I set the last vase at the foot of the stairs for Andy to take upstairs. When he shows up several hours later, I hold my breath as he steps into the hall. "What's this?" he exclaims. "How glorious!" As he trudges up the stairs, he calls, "It's going to be a good day, Christina. A very good day indeed." One hot afternoon, I hear Andy pad down the stairs and out the front door. From the window in the kitchen, I watch him pacing around barefoot in the grass. Hands on hips, he stares out at the sea. Then he walks slowly back to the house and materializes in the kitchen. "I just can't see it," he says, rubbing the back of his neck. "See what?" He sits heavily on a stool. "Lemonade?" I offer. "Sure." I rise from my chair and grope along the wall to the narrow pantry, using the table, Andy's rocker, and the wall for balance. Normally I'd be self-conscious, but Andy is so lost in thought he doesn't even notice. Betsy, 7 months pregnant and grumpy in the heat, left a pitcher of fresh-squeezed lemonade on the counter before returning home for a nap. When I lift the glass pitcher with both hands, it wobbles, and I splash the liquid all over my arm. Annoyed at myself, I dab at it with a damp dish rag before carefully carrying the glass to Andy. "Thanks." Absent-mindedly, he licks the side of his hand where it's sticky from the glass. As I settle back into my chair, he says, "You know, I spend entire days up there just dreaming. It feels like so much wasted time. But I can't seem to do it any other way." He takes a long swig of lemonade and sets the empty glass on the floor. "Christ, I don't know. I'm no artist. But I think I understand what he means. Some things take the time they take. You can't make the hens lay before they're ready." He nods, and I feel emboldened. Sometimes I want the bread to rise quicker, but if I try to rush it, I ruin it. Breaking into a grin, he says, "That's true." I feel a small glow in the pit of my stomach. "You have an artist's soul, Christina." "Well, I don't know about that. We have more in common than you think," he says. Later, I reflect on the things we have in common and the things we don't. Our stubbornness and our infirmities. Our circumscribed childhoods. His father kept him out of school. We're alike in that way. But NC trained him to be a painter, and Papa trained me to take care of the house, and there's a world of difference in that. Some of Andy's sketches are hurried outlines. A map of the painting to come. A hint of a figure. Grasses growing this way and that. Geometric slashes of house and barn. Others are precisely shaded and detailed. Every strand of hair and fold of fabric. The wood grain on the pantry door. His watercolors are inky greens and browns. The sky merely the white of the paper. Al in his flat-visored cap with his pipe, raking blueberries in the field. Sitting on the front doorstep, gathering hay. The fine figure of our dun-colored mare Tessie in profile. Andy sketches the scarred wooden table, the white teapot. Egg scales. Grain bags in the barn. Seed corn hanging to dry in a third-floor bedroom. On his canvases, these objects look the same, but different. They have a burnished glow. Andy's father paints in oil, he tells me. But he prefers egg tempera, he says. The method of European masters like Giotto and Botticelli in the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance. It dries quickly, leaving a muted effect. I watch as he cracks an egg, separates the yolk from the white, and rolls the plump sack gently between his hands to remove the albumen. He pokes the yolk with the tip of a knife, pours the orange liquid into a cup of distilled water, stirs it around with his finger, adds a chalky powdered pigment to make a paste. After dipping a small brush into the tempera, he presses out the wetness and color with his fingers and splays the tip to make dry spiky strokes. He layers it over a pale wash of color, or pencil and ink on a masonite fiberboard coated with gesso, a smooth mix of rabbit skin glue and chalk. Though he works fast, the brush strokes are painstaking and meticulous, each one distinct. Cross-hatched grass, a dense, dark row of plantings. When wet, the colors are as red as Indian paintbrush, russet as clay. Blue as the bay on a summer afternoon, green as a holly leaf. These bright wet colors fade as they dry, leaving a ghostly glow, intensity. Painting emotions into objects is the only thing I care about, he says. Over time, Andy's paintings become starker, drained of color, austere, mostly white and brown and gray and black. Damn it to hell, Andy murmurs, cocking his head to look at a newly finished watercolor. Al's shadowy figure walking down the rows in his visored cap, the white house and gray barn stark on the horizon. This is better. Betsy was right. When he isn't upstairs painting, Andy hovers near me like a bee around honeycomb. He is fascinated with our habits and routines. How are the hens laying? How do you make a perfect loaf of bread without measuring? How do you keep the slugs from the dahlias? What kinds of trees does Al cut for firewood? What type of sail do lobstermen around here use on their boats? How do you collect the water in the cistern? Why are so many things in the house painted the same shade of blue? Why is a dory marooned in the rafters of the shed? Why is that long ladder propped against the house? We don't have a telephone, Al explains in his laconic way. And the closest fire company is 9 miles from here. If there's a roof or chimney fire... Got it, Andy says. These questions are easy to answer. But over time his inquiries become more personal. Why do Al and I live here alone with all these empty rooms? What was it like when it was full of people, before most of the fields went to flower? At first I'm guarded. It just turned out that way, I tell him. Life was busier then. Andy isn't satisfied with evasions. Why did it turn out that way? Did you or Al ever want to live somewhere, anywhere else? It's hard to say what's in my head. It's been a long time since anyone cared to ask, he insists. I want to know.
So little by little, I open up. I tell him about the trip to Rockland when I refuse to see the doctor. The disappearing treasure in Mystery Tunnel. The witches, the sea captains, the ship stranded in ice. What did you miss about going to school? Why were you so scared of doctors? He is as gentle as a dog, as curious as a cat. Who are you, Christina Olsen? In the shell room one afternoon, Andy finds Papa's wooden box of keepsakes and opens the lid. He strokes the smooth tines of the whalebone comb, picks up the tiny tin soldier and raises its arms with his forefinger. Whose is this? My father's. This box is the only thing of his I kept after he died. I used to collect toy soldiers. He muses. When I was a boy, I created a whole battlefield. I still have a row of them lined up on the windowsill in my studio in Pennsylvania. He sets the soldier back in the box and runs a finger over the black lump of anthracite. Why do you think he held on to this? He liked rocks and minerals, he said. This is anthracite, right? I nod. Coal's glamorous cousin, he says. In the Civil War, did your father tell you this? Anthracite was used by Confederate blockade runners as fuel for their steamships to avoid giving themselves away. It burns clean, no smoke. I never heard that, I say. But I think, how apt. Papa was never one to give himself away. They called them ghost ships. It's a terrifying image, isn't it? These ominous ships materializing out of nowhere. He sets the anthracite back in the box and shuts the lid. Did he ever go back to Sweden? No. But I'm named after his mother. Anna Christina Olausen. Did you know her? I shake my head. It's strange, don't you think, to name your child after a living person you've chosen never to see again? Not so strange, he says. There's this great line from the House of the Seven Gables. The world owes all its onward impulses to men ill at ease. Your father must have felt he had to forge his own path, even if it meant cutting ties to his family. It's brave to resist the pull of the familiar, to be selfish about your own needs. I wrestle with that every day. Several months after Andy and Betsy returned to Chad's Ford for the winter, I get a letter from Betsy. In September, she gave birth to a sickly child, Nicholas, who needed a lot of special care but seems to be all right. In November, Andy was drafted into the Army. When he reported for his physical, they took one look at his twisted right leg and his flat feet and rejected him on the spot. He truly feels he's been given a reprieve and is determined to make the most of it, she writes. A reprieve of one sort, I think. But though I may not have a child of my own, I know all too well how the demands of family life can become consuming. I wonder if, as a father now, Andy will feel even more torn between the pull of the familiar and the creative impulses that drive him. 1913 to 1914. I'm in the hen house early on a warm June morning, gathering eggs, when I hear voices coming closer across the field. We're not expecting visitors. Standing up straight, I lower the warm eggs I'm holding into the pocket of my apron and listen closely. Ramona Carl, I'd recognize her throaty laugh anywhere. Ramona, along with her siblings, Alva and Eloise, are summer folk from Massachusetts, whose family bought the Seavey homestead down the road several years ago. Alva is the oldest. Eloise is my age, Ramona a few years younger. They stay in Cushing from Memorial Day to Labor Day. But unlike some other fromaways, with their languid indolence, their impulsive thrill-seeking, the Carls do their best to fit in with the locals. I always look forward to seeing them. They organize egg-in-spoon races at our annual 4th of July clam bake on Hawthorne Point. Convince everyone to play games like Red Rover and Ollie Infree, and bring bags of fireworks to light after dark. Ramona is my favorite.
a friendly, impulsive girl. She is slight and energetic, with hair the color of melted chocolate and eyes as large and shiny as a fawn's. Once when I was with her in town, an old lady told her she was as cute as a button. No one has ever said anything remotely like that to me. Ducking out of the hen house with my bounty of eggs and a big smile of anticipation, I nearly run into a man I've never seen before. "Why, hello," I say.
"Hello."
He's about my age, I think. I've just turned 20. And about half a foot taller than me, with light brown hair that flops in front of wide-set blue eyes. He's wearing thin linen pants and a soft white shirt with the sleeves rolled above his elbows. Self-conscious all of a sudden, I smooth my sleep-matted hair, glancing down at the soiled apron I baked bread in this morning and the wooden clogs I wear to wade through mud.
"Walton Hall,"
he says, extending his hand. "Christina Olson." His hand is surprisingly soft. This is a man who has never handled a plow. "Walton is visiting from Malden," Ramona says. "He and Eloise went to high school together. At the end of the summer, he's heading off to Harvard."
"Admit it, you're shocked,"
Walton says with a small wink.
"Must not be as dull as he looks."
"Just because you're going to Harvard doesn't mean you're not dull," I say. When he smiles, I see that one of his front teeth slightly overlaps the other. He raises an invisible glass in a mock toast.
"Good point."
"All right, enough," Ramona says. "Let me remind you, Walton, that an entire household awaits breakfast."
Yes, he says. "We've come to procure some eggs."
"Right," I say. "How many?"
2 dozen, yes, Ramona?"
She nods. "Okay, that'll be 50 cents for the eggs and a penny for the bag," I tell them.
"My word, you drive a hard bargain."
Ramona rolls her eyes. "You could have asked for 50 cents an egg, Christina. He has no idea what he's talking about." One by one, I slide the eggs into a bag, counting out 24 as he teases.
"Not that one. It's not oval enough.
And
they must all be exactly the same size."
He is standing quite close to me, and his breath smells of butterscotch. Ramona's talking about the weather, how dull a winter it was, and how she counted the days until June. "What a beautiful day it is today. But do you think it might take a turn? Will it be calm enough to go out for a sail later on?" She wonders what her mother will do with all these eggs if breakfast is over by the time they get back. A souffle, perhaps? An omelet? A lemon meringue pie?
"Come with us,"
he says. Ramona and I both look up.
"What?"
I say, confused.
"Come sailing this afternoon, Christina,"
he says.
"The wind will be perfect."
"You might have said that when I was fretting about the weather," Ramona mutters. I don't usually take off afternoons, especially to sail with strange boys I've only just met. "Thank you, but I can't. I have to make bread, and my chores."
"Oh, for heaven's sake, come along," Ramona says.
"We have to entertain Walton somehow. And bring your brother Sam. He's such fun. I need someone my own age to flirt with." "I'm sorry, I don't think so."
"My word, you're a hard sell. Look, I'll sign your hall pass,"
Walton says. "Hall pass?" Seeing my puzzlement, Ramona laughs. "They don't have hall passes in one-room schoolhouses, Walton." "I can't," I say. He shakes his head and shrugs.
"Oh, well. Another day, then."
"Maybe." "That means yes," Ramona tells him with the confidence of a girl accustomed to getting her way. She flashes me a smile. "We'll try again, soon." When I return to the house from the brightness of the yard, I lean against the wall in the dim foyer, breathing heavily.
What was that?
"Did I hear voices?" Mother calls from the kitchen. I touch my face, smooth the front of my blouse. Take a deep breath.
"Was somebody here?"
she asks when I come in, untying my apron and taking it off. "Oh," I say, straining for a casual tone. "Only Ramona, to buy eggs.
I could have sworn I heard a male voice.
Just a friend of the Carls.
Ah, well, the dough's ready for kneading.
I'll get to it, I say.
Over the next few weeks, Ramona and Walton, sometimes with Eloise and Alva, stop by every other day or so, seeking eggs or milk or a roasting chicken, staying longer each visit. They bring a picnic basket and an old quilt, and we sit on the grass, drinking tea steeped in the sun. I come to expect the sight of them, sauntering up the field in the late morning or early afternoon. My brothers, with their gentle ways, tend to shy like deer from the summer folk, but the Carls and Walton gradually win them over. When they're finished with chores, Al and Sam often join us on the grass. One morning, when it's just Walton and Ramona and me, Ramona says,
"We're kidnapping you, Christina. It's a perfect day for a sail."
"But..."
"No buts.
The farm will manage without you. Alva is waiting. Off we go."
As we make our way down the path toward the shore, I feel Walton's eyes on me from behind. Aware of my awkward gait, I concentrate carefully on my movements. In front of us, Ramona chatters away.
"The sun is so bright." "Mercy, I did not even think of it, but we do not have enough hats.
Maybe Mother left one or two on the boat."
Seemingly unaware that neither Walton nor I say a word in response. And then the very thing I fear happens. I trip on a root. My legs buckle. I feel myself pitching forward. Before I can make a sound, an arm is under mine. In a low voice, so Ramona won't hear, Walton says, "What a long path this is." Though only moments ago I was flushed with anxiety, now I am oddly calm.
"Thank you," I whisper.
I have never been this close to a boy who isn't related to me. My sense is sharp. I notice everything in the clean morning light. Daffodils pale and bowed. Guillemots gliding overhead. Black with bright red wings, squeaking like mice. The trees in the distance. Red spruce and firs and juniper and slender Scotch pines that frame the field. I taste the salt on my lips from the sea. But mostly, I am aware of the warm mammal scent of this boy whose arm is ballast. Sweat, perhaps. And the musky smell of his hair, a whiff of aftershave, sweet butterscotch on his breath.
"I hope you won't think this impertinent, but did you know that the blue flowers in your dress match your eyes exactly?" he murmurs.
"I did not," I manage to answer. The Carl's boat is a single-mast sloop, with a jib in the front and a large white mainsail attached to the back of the wooden mast. They keep a wooden dinghy on the shore near Kissing Cove, paddles tucked inside, to row out to the sailboat. When we get to the beach, Alva is waving from the deck of the sloop, about 100 yards out into the bay. We drag the dinghy to the water. Walton insists on taking the oars, and we meander toward the sailboat this way and that. I have to bite my lips to keep from laughing. His strokes are choppy and inexpert. Nothing like Al's rhythmic motion. When we arrive at the boat, Ramona ties the small craft to the buoy, and Walton, taking Alva's proffered hand, jumps up first so the two of them can assist us.
"Gallant of you, I suppose, but unnecessary," Ramona says, batting away Walton's hand.
I don't protest. I need all the help I can get. Once aboard, I'm more at ease. It's a mild, warm morning, with a gentle wind, and I know how to sail, having learned with Alvaro on his small skiff. Alva hoists the mainsail, which flaps dramatically in the wind like a sheet on a clothesline, and I pull down firmly on the halyard until it stops. He turns the boat to starboard, weaving away from the wind, lessening the tilt to bring us to a more comfortable sailing angle as we approach open water. I have to warn Walton to duck, so he won't get hit in the head by the boom. He seems surprised and a little impressed that I seem to know what I'm doing.
So many hidden talents.
It's a miracle that I'm any help to Alva, given how distracted I am by the skin on Walton's neck.
slightly sunburned just above his collar, the small flaps of his ears turning pink in the sun, the quick flash of his gray-blue eyes. Alva, passionate for sailing in the way that boys who grew up on boats with their fathers and grandfathers can be, is happy to do the brunt of the work. And once we're out on the ocean, we fall into an easy rhythm. Ramona opens a basket and cuts chunks of bread, slices of cheese, passes around hard-boiled eggs and salt, and a tin canteen of water. In the course of conversation, I learn bits and pieces about Walton's upbringing. His mother is obsessed with social decorum. His father, a banker, who stays in Boston in a small apartment several nights a week. When he has to work late, or at least that's what he tells us, Walton says. I'm not sure what he's implying and fear it's rude to ask. I don't want to look ignorant, but also don't want to pry. It's as hard to picture where Walton grew up as it is to imagine life on the moon. I conjure parlor rooms out of Jane Austen, a red brick mansion. The walls of the dining room adorned with gilt-framed paintings of Harvard-educated ancestors. He tells me that he had a curved spine, scoliosis as a child, and had to wear a plaster body cast for a long, hot summer after an operation when he was 12. While other boys were climbing trees and kicking balls around, he lay in bed reading adventure stories like Swiss Family Robinson and Captain's Courageous. He doesn't say so. But I know he's trying to explain that he understands what it's like to be me. As the hours pass, the sky drains of warmth. It's not until I notice goosebumps on my arms that I realize I've forgotten a sweater. Without a word, Walton peels off his jacket and drapes it around my shoulders. "Oh," I say with surprise. "I hope that wasn't too forward of me. You seemed chilly." "Yes. Thank you. I didn't expect it. In truth, I can't remember the last time anyone noticed my physical discomfort and did something about it. When you live on a farm, everyone is uncomfortable much of the time. Too cold, too warm, dirty, bone-tired, banged up, injured by a tool or hot grate, too preoccupied to worry much about each other. You're quite an independent girl, aren't you?" "I suppose I am." "You've never met anyone like Christina, Walton," Ramona says. "She's not like those silly girls in Malden who don't know how to light a fire or clean a fish." "Is she a suffragette like Miss Pankhurst?" he asks in a teasing voice. I feel woefully ignorant. I don't know what a suffragette is, and I've never heard of Miss Pankhurst. I think of all the years Walton spent in school while I was washing and cooking and cleaning. "A suffragette? You know, those ladies starving themselves for the vote," Ramona says. "The ones who think, God forbid, they can do anything a man can do."
"Is that what you think?" Walton asks me.
"Well, I don't know," I say. "Shall we have a competition and find out? We could split logs for firewood, or fix a drainpipe, or maybe slaughter a chicken?"
"Careful," he says, laughing. "Miss Pankhurst was just sentenced to 3 years in jail for her treasonous words."
There is, I am almost certain, a spark between us. A flickering. I glance at Ramona. She raises her eyebrows at me and smiles. And I know she senses it, too. One day, Walton shows up alone on a bicycle. He's wearing a pinstriped sack coat and a straw boater. Not the kind of hat any man around here would wear. For that matter, they don't wear pinstriped sack coats either. Around my brothers, he looks slightly preposterous, like a peacock in a cluster of turkeys. Holding his hat between his hands, he kneads the brim with his long fingers.
"I'm here to do you the favor of relieving you of some eggs. Can you believe they've entrusted me with this important task?"
And then, conspiratorially, "Actually, they have no idea I'm here." "I'll get my coat," I say.
"Don't think you need one," he says. "It's not actually..."
But I've already shut the door. I stand in the dark hall, my heart thudding in my ears. I don't know how to act.
Maybe I should tell him that I'm needed in the... A rap on the door.
Are you there? All right if I come inside?
I reach up to the coat pegs and pull down the first thing I find, Sam's heavy wool jacket.